Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life, and today I have with me New York Times best-selling author of Wild Bill and other books that he's written, Halsey's Typhoon, Dodge City, Tom Klaven. Tom, how are you tonight?
I am fine. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You've been on the program before. We were talking about Dodge City the last time, and now you have a blockbuster out there called Wild Bill. Let me ask you this question, which is about Bill Hickok. Why do you pick these characters? They're almost like the Avengers of yesteryear. Is there something about that?
Yeah, that's a good analogy, because the people like Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson and Wild Bill Hickok and Buffalo Bill Cody is another one you could throw in there. They were sort of like the superheroes of the American West. You know, one reason was because they did things that ordinary people didn't do.
They shoot people.
Well, not only just shoot people, but they did extraordinary things as a lawman, too. I mean, Wild Bill Hickok cleaned up Abilene, and you had Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson in Dodge City. But also because they caught the imaginations of these what they call dime store novelists. And they used to crank out these books, even while they were still alive. Crank out these books that were basically made-up stories starring these real-life characters. And so their fame, they really started to achieve the superhero status of doing these extraordinary things. Now, occasionally, they'd be true.
There was some truth in what they were saying.
There was usually a little bit of truth so that the writer was not doing a complete fabrication. But there was even, I found in my research for the Wild Bill Hickok book, they were Wild Bill comic books, you know, decades ago.
At that time?
Not at that time, but a little bit afterwards, when they started to actually have comic books, pen and ink kind of things, that Wild Bill became a star of them. So there's another, and he was like the Spider-Man, the Marvel comic Spider-Man of the American West.
Wow, that's amazing. So how do you decipher the truth from the myth?
That's tough with some of these figures, because and especially tough in the case of Wild Bill, because he died when he was 39 years old, and he was killed when he was 39 years old. So you don't have a time in his life like Wyatt Earp had.
How did he die?
He was shot in Deadwood, South Dakota, and a man came up behind him and shot him from behind while he was playing poker. That's where we get the famous Dead Man's Hand. He was holding aces and eights and a queen. And in his hand when he slumped over with the bullet in the back of the head. And because he was the undisputed, undefeated heavyweight champion of gunfighters. And nobody could beat him, coming at him straight on. There was nobody. So he survived confrontation after confrontation. The only way to kill him was to come up from behind him. And that's what the cowardly Jack McCann, I think his name was, that's what he did.
And what was his intention? I mean, obviously to kill him, but I mean, why?
It's one of the great mysteries of American history, because the background of this guy is kind of murky to begin with. And he was in Deadwood, seemed to be just passing through, and he had played cards with Hickok the day before and gotten wiped out, not just by Hickok, but he was just a bad poker player.
Right.
So everybody was taking advantage of him. Hickok actually gave him some money and said, here, at least have some money for some breakfast in the morning, and don't play poker until you learn how to be a better poker player. There's a theory, was he felt condescended to, so he said, I'm going to get that guy. Or it's like one of those strange mysteries of American history that somebody, for unknown reasons, does something that makes its mark on history. And that was the case here. I mean, Wild Bill, most people don't know that because of an eye ailment, he would eventually have gone blind. He would have been a blind gunfighter, which doesn't have a high, you know, survival rate. Well, so it's almost like this guy existed only to kill Wild Bill when he was 39 years old and make sure that he would always be a legend in America, of the American
wow.
West.
That is amazing. That is amazing. How did he get his nickname, Wild Bill? Where did that come from?
He grew up in a family that on a farm in Illinois that was a station on the Underground Railroad. His parents were very anti-slavery. They actually helped escape runaway slaves. They would transport them to the house them, protect them, take them to the next place on the Underground Railroad. And so Hickok grew up always hating injustice, unfairness, bullying, unfair fights, anything like that. And one day in the first year of the Civil War, he's walking down the street. I think he was in the Springfield, Missouri, Independence, Missouri. And there was a big commotion in a saloon. And people were standing at the doorway looking in. So he stopped. What's going on? And they said the bartender there had expressed some sympathy for the Southern cause. And there were six guys drinking in there who were Union guys. So they all jumped on the bartender. Now, Hickok was anti-slavery, but he hated an unfair fight. He goes in there with fists flying, extricates the bartender, beats up the other six guys. And so a few hours later, he's walking down the street, and the word is all over town. And some woman goes over and sees him and recognizes him and says, "Way to go, Wild Bill." Because it was a wild, crazy thing that he did.
Wow.
And the name stuck.
And that's it.
That's it.
That's fascinating. He had like nine lives, too, didn't he?
He did. He had all these occupations. I mean, he was an Army scout. He was a spy for the Union behind Confederate lines in the
Civil
War.
That's the thing when I was reading, the spy part is fascinating.
He was a federal lawman. He was a marshal of Abilene and Hays City. He was a Broadway actor, a successful Broadway actor. You know, he and Buffalo Bill Cody.
Now, wait a second. Was he a Broadway actor before he became Wild Bill?
No, His life was spent in Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska. He was a man of the plains. That's why,
How did he get to Broadway?
He was a plainsman, but...
My daughter wants to know this, by the way.
When he had cleaned up Abilene so well, the crime rate was so low when he was done with Abilene that they fired him because they said, "We don't need a marshal anymore. This is a great job." So he's sitting around gambling. He doesn't know what to do with himself. Buffalo Bill Cody shows up and says, "I've got this script called Scouts of the Plains. It's basically you, me, a guy named Texas Jack, and a couple of people playing Indians, sitting around on the stage, sitting around a campfire, talking about and reenacting to some extent some of our exploits out on the plains. Why don't you come in with me and we'll do this?" Hickok was reluctant. He thought that sounded silly. But he needed the money. He got offered $100 a week. So he took it, and so they did a couple of out-of-town tryouts of this play. They brought it to New York. It was a smash hit. I mean, they were making $20,000 a week.
Wow.
And in 1873, that was incredible money.
That's like unbelievable.
But when you think about it, for a New York audience that had been reading about these legendary characters,
they couldn't
get
enough of them.
All they had to do was put down $1.50, and you could see them right on stage in front of you. So it was a smash hit. And they did it until Hickok finally, he couldn't stand doing acting anymore. He couldn't stand being Wild Bill Hickok, playing Wild Bill Hickok. It just seemed like a silly way to make a living. So one night he got fed up, he took his gun out, he shot the spotlights out, and he left. Went back west.
I love it. Now, it's something that we were talking about earlier. This is, you're working on a trilogy because now you're already on your third book, which is probably, going to be the first part of the trilogy? Or?
Wild Bill is going to end up being the first part of the trilogy because
that's
mostly in the 1860s and early 70s. Then you have Dodge City, which came out first, but it's going to be the middle part of the trilogy when all is said and done because that's the 1870s. And then I'm just finishing up a book on Tombstone and the gunfight at the O.K. Corral, which took place in the early 1880s. That's going to be actually the third part and concluding the story, sort of coming full circle from Wild Bill, the very first gunman, to Tombstone and the last gunfight, basically.
Wow.
That's what it was. So it's going to have that arc to it.
That's fantastic. You know, Tom Clavin, it's been a delight having you on this program. Your book, Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter, it's a fantastic book. You should go out and get this Amazon, wherever, right?
And support your local bookstore, please.
Yeah, absolutely. This is John Christopher, your host for Real Life, and we're broadcasting on 88.3 FM WPPB from the oceanside and bayside town of Southampton, New York. We'll be right back after this short break with New York City's real estate agent extraordinaire, Madeline Hincus. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have with me Madeline Hincus, who is a Manhattan's real estate agent extraordinaire. Hi, Madeline. How are you today?
I'm fine, John. How are you?
Good. I know I got a little chuckle from you just then, but I believe that. But Madeline, besides being a fantastic Manhattan agent, you have a soft spot for artistic performers like ballerinas and musical theater actors. So you've put together what you call a masterclass on what it takes to rent an apartment in New York City. Can you elaborate on that?
I can. So what we discovered is these kids come to, for example, American Ballet Theater. They work their basically entire life, they get the phone call. You're in. You are now a professional dancer. They have about 2 weeks to a month to find an apartment in New York City with no income yet behind them. Bit of a challenge.
A little bit.
We started noticing a severe problem. They were staying in places they shouldn't be. Some of them actually had to turn down contracts. They couldn't stay. They had no way to support themselves.
And these are kids that have been working all their lives in their chosen profession.
Correct. Heavy training, just real focus. I mean, they have a lot to offer the arts and a lot to offer New York City, for that matter.
And all of a sudden, now they have to find a place with a roof.
And our guidelines for New York City are, as anyone who's tried, is 40 times if you have a good income behind you, good credit, or 80 times the rent if you can find someone to be what's called a guarantor.
Okay, so wait a second. 40 times what? Like if the kid is making, let's say, American Ballet, I don't know what they would pay, but just use round figures. Say, is $40,000 normal? Would you say is that an arbitrary figure?
Well, and it's less about the income. Most people who come to the city, if it's their first job and they don't have anything behind them yet, they're going to ask for a guarantor. So they may
automatically.
They may be able to afford it, but understandably, the landlords want something behind them.
Well, what about their parents? Yeah.
You know, if you do the math on this, so 40 times if we put them in a studio, that's the parents have to make at least $80,000. And then we have a child trying to support themselves. $2,000 a month is a big nut to crack when you're starting out. So right. We'd like to double them up.
Right. Boy, that sounds really difficult. So what happens? A lot of these kids just, you know, at that point, they can't get an apartment?
They often can't get an apartment or, you know, they're going to go somewhere far. You know, they'll travel over an hour to try to stay with a family member or a friend, commuting in to do performances at the Met, going home, back for rehearsal. It's like the cards are stacked against them right from the start.
Right. So how does your program help them?
So what we've learned is if we have a guarantor behind these kids, and again, whatever the rent is 80 times. So as long as somebody makes $160,000 on the $2,000, they put up no money. They simply guarantor behind this person's salary that they would be there. We have never had an incident where these highly trained, very dedicated young dancers have gone back on their commitment to the rent.
Wow. So they'll pay the rent, but the question is they can't just get into the apartment without this guarantee coming from a guarantor.
Correct. So for anyone who's ever wanted to be a donator to the arts or, you know, really likes to support young people, it is an outstanding way, without actually passing over funds, to do a major benefit for these kids. You'll see them on the stage. You know who you are a guarantor for. You can be a guarantor for more than one kid. And at that point, you know, you can watch the fruits of what you've delivered in this guarantor to see them dance, and they go on to have a career, and within a year they're all set, they're on their feet.
Now you must have like a waiting list of people wanting to do this.
I try to do them all simultaneously. I don't have enough guarantors.
Interesting. Because to me it sounds like something that's, there's not much effort, there's not money coming out of your pocket, but you're doing something that's really good, that's helping the arts.
Correct. And plus you have large company behind you, whether it's New York City Ballet, I've had those dancers, or American Ballet Theater. We monitor it. We pay attention. We teach them all about renting and responsibilities. We follow up with these kids. They get it. They get what someone is giving to them.
Oh, that's fantastic. So how does one, you know, donate, or how do they join your...
Well, mainly they can reach out to me because I have no less than 6 dancers at a time ready to go. That's what I have right now. And I have 0 guarantors for them. So I am taking the next month to hunt and beg and hope somebody can support them so that they can go on to join American Ballet Theater in the fall.
They can reach you. Do you have a phone number?
Or? I'm at 860-930-9646.
Again, please.
860-930-9646. 416.
Right. And they would reach you, Madeline, right? Or
they'll talk directly to me and I'll explain the entire process to them.
That is really unbelievable. Okay. I think that's a fantastic thing, and I you know, commend you on what you're doing. On the other side of the coin, on the real estate market, because you also do handle the real estate market, and we have a few minutes left, what are your thoughts about the market in Manhattan right now?
I think I can't believe what I'm seeing some of these apartments going for. It's a great time to buy.
That's my question. Do you think it's a buying time?
It is a buying time for sure, whether it's a co-op or a condo. And even as a seller right now, prices are fair. Anything that was escalated has come down, and the transactions are moving. But if there was hesitancy, just wanting to watch in the past, it's time. It's unbelievable in markets that we couldn't touch for a while, for people just, especially first apartments, one bedrooms, you know, you can pretty much have your pick of any area right now.
Right. So do you think, because I've had an economist on here talking about, you know, the correction, do you think we're at the bottom of that correction?
I mean, we're close.
Mm-hmm.
We're close. Again, it's not that it's, you know, rock bottom or anything. I don't know if New York City can go rock bottom, but it can level off and be at a fair market value.
Do you think there's any, you know, everybody speculates why it is the way it is, but nobody has given any rationale to it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think everybody's a bit jumpy right now, just with the current climate. I think it makes people take stock of greed, and everyone's entering the market, both sides, sellers and buyers, with a little more reality than they have in the past.
So how can someone, again, get in touch with you, Madeline?
Again, through that number, or I have an email, but the phone
Please.
Is...
Yeah, what's your email?
The email's my name, madeline.hinkis@sotheby'shomes.com.
Fantastic. Madeline, it's been such a delight having you on the program. This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back after a short break with our next guest, co-author of I Can, I Will, I Must, Eric File. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and today I have with me author and chief operating officer of Dan's Paper, Eric File. So, Eric, besides being the COO and editorial director of Dan's Paper, you're now also the co-author with Alan Schnorman of a new book entitled I Can, I Will, I Must. So what prompted you to want to write this book?
You know, it's funny, being a writer for magazines and newspapers over the years, I've always done short pieces, 1,500 words, a few thousand words, and it's like this sprint every single time to hit your deadline. And every writer, I think, has inside them, they believe, a book, whether it's fiction, nonfiction. And I had met Alan at a party for Behind the Hedges, our real estate magazine. This was back at the end of 2014. And he and I started chatting, and he had this incredible story. And it's funny, when we first met, I couldn't figure out how a guy who told me he had only been a broker for 2 years at that point knew so much about real estate. I mean, this guy knew everything. And at the end of the party, he says to me, you know what? Give me a call. You should do a story on me. That'd be an interesting story. And you know, out here, everybody in the Hamptons thinks they have an interesting story.
Right.
And, you know, some of them are, but most of them are not, at least beyond themselves. And I said, you know what? I'm charmed by you, Alan. Let's have lunch. So we had lunch, and then he told me his story. And I wrote an article for Behind the Hedges, and he loved it, and I loved writing it. And he said, you know, I have a lot more. Why don't we do a book? And I said, you know what? If it's with you, I am in. And that was the start of the journey.
You know, the book, though it's real estate oriented, you know, I found it to be almost like a self-help book. Was that the intention when you wrote it?
Absolutely. It's funny. Sort of the elevator pitch that I've given when people have asked me what the book is. I said, it's Tuesdays with Maury meets Real Estate Investing 101 meets The Power of Positive Thinking meets How to Win Friends and Influence People. And that really encapsulates everything that Alan is all about. He has great real estate advice, whether as a developer, as a broker in Aspen, in the Hamptons, in New York. He has done it all, and he knows that intimately. And he wants to teach people. He loves to teach because he loves learning. But the part about him that's inspiring is his story also outside real estate, whether it's how he grew up or how he started Lawline television show that became the longest running show, was on PBS for 30 years. He'd never done a TV show before. How he'd hurt his back, and then he climbed Everest and, you know, up to base camp at least. Not all the way to the top, but that's, there's, you know, life is, you know, long. You can still go. How he ran marathons when he had never done it before. So all these facets of his life, people can apply to no matter what they're doing. So yeah, if you want to invest in real estate, there's great, great advice in here. But whether you are a writer and you want to write a book, Alan's words inspired me. I would say to myself every single day when I had to write, I can, I will, I must, because I had to write this late at night on weekends. Sometimes it's very tiring.
Yeah, because you're very busy. Your schedule is...
Exactly right. I mean, Dan's paper, it's a full-time job. So to be able to do this was a great labor of love, but you had to have this motivation that comes from working with and knowing Alan and reading the book.
Right. So having written the book, has it made you think about investing in real estate?
It has. You know, it's very, very funny. Sometimes I'd be sitting there late at night, and whether I'd be transcribing. So the Tuesdays with Maury part came. I talked to Alan every Thursday, no matter what. Rain, shine, time of year, we would talk. I would transcribe the interviews and then try to figure out over the years how to piece it together to make a story. So I'd be working late at night often, and I would take a little break. I would start to look up some property in my area, because Alan's advice has always been, pick an area, learn it inside out, to see what things were renting for, what things were selling for, and to learn an area and really learn how to do investing. So absolutely, it sparked it. Now, if there's someone out there who wants to, you know, give me a little seed money, we can go into business together and invest.
That's right. That's the next thing, right? You know, we've had conversations before about our parents, and do you see a lot of your dad in Alan?
You know, it's funny. The book, one of the people I did mention the acknowledgments is my father, who was the single hardest working person I have ever seen. I mean, the man was sick, I recall, one day in his life, and he worked Saturday, Sunday, Monday, probably 9 days a week if he could squeeze it in. But he was always a very positive guy. Nothing ever got him down. And, you know, growing up, you don't realize the financial challenges your parents may have or the relationship challenges. You know, everything's not always sunshine and lollipops. But he was always telling us things are good. You know what? You can do this. You can do that. I'm going to go do this. He was a teacher. Then he became an entrepreneur and started businesses. So Alan, very entrepreneurial, and again, and inspiring to his kids and everybody out there. So yeah, there is a little bit of my dad and Alan, and a little bit of Alan and everybody out there.
It seems that way. I know. He's a very infectious guy.
Absolutely.
Now you have a number of employees under your guidance. Alan's favorite expression is RAP, R-A-P. Can you elaborate on that expression of his?
Absolutely. So it's repetition. And then you want to acknowledge them and you want to praise them. And this you want to do publicly and privately. Everybody in a job, you assume, is doing the best they can at every moment. Everything they do does not come out perfectly. So whether it's somebody on our team, somebody doing a story as a writer, a designer doing something creative, somebody on the ad sales team, and there will be moments where, yes, you need to discuss and help them because they have challenges that they're trying to meet. But you always want to publicly, in front of their peers and in front of their clients, where it is, praise them when they do something. Recognize the effort. Recognize when they've done something good. And acknowledge it to the world, saying, hey, this is something that John or Jane has done well, and let's give them a round of applause. And it's not necessarily monetary. I mean, Alan and I have had this talk. Monetary rewards and recognition are very important. That's why people work and they have jobs. But the praise that comes from it and having people being recognized publicly is very, very important. So I will try to do that all the time. It's something that I've, you know, try to do with my daughter, try to do it with your friends. You always want to give people public and private praise and let them know you appreciate them.
Absolutely. I agree with that. I know he says teamwork makes the dream work. Do you apply that philosophy?
Absolutely. Nobody can do anything alone. It simply doesn't work. So you have to have a team, and a team has leaders and a team has other players, but everybody plays an important role. And recognizing that role and recognizing the role that others play and how it all comes together is incredibly important. And again, not just in publishing, not just in real estate, but any walk of life. Teamwork really, really matters. And people who don't recognize that find themselves sometimes out in the cold and not succeeding as much as they would if they don't embrace the team idea.
Exactly, exactly. Now, Dan's paper is celebrating 60 years in business. What are some events that Dan's is involved in?
So Dan's 60 summers this year. We have a number of food and wine events. On the 19th of July, we have Grill Hampton down in Bridgehampton at Fairview Farm. Saturday the 20th is Dan's Taste of Two Forks, our ninth annual. Friday, August 2nd is the 60 Summers Gala and Dan Ratiner's 80th birthday party.
Oh my goodness.
And that's going to be out at the new Star Island Gurney's Montauk Yacht Club. Because Dan's Papers was
found. I bet you that's going to be a blast.
It will be a blast right there, you know, sort of with the guise of the lighthouse out there. And the Montauk Pioneer was how Dan's Papers started. Right. That was the first one. And then the next night, the 3rd of August, is Montauk, and that wraps up our summer food and wine event. So it's a big celebration for everybody and a big celebration of the East End.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. Now, how can somebody get this book that you've written with Alan? I Can, I Will, I Must.
So the book, I Can, I Will, I Must, you can go to icanwillimust.com. You can buy it on Amazon. And out here on the East End, it is available at Bookhampton in East Hampton, at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor, at the new Sag Harbor Books, and in Southampton at Southampton Books. So locally and universally.
Fantastic. Eric Feil, it's been a delight having you on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You have been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people, places, and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, broker associate with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch, theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life is also brought to you in part by LEAP Compliance, HR's one-stop solution for sexual harassment prevention training and policies. All employers in the New York State are now required to train all employees annually, no matter the size of the company. For more information, discriminationpreventiontraining.com or 646-216-8038.